What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering
you
again.
You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men.
He that shall blaspheme against the Holy Ghost hath never forgiveness.
Just in case anyone out there is not a history buff, Nat Turner's slave rebellion, a little bit more than a dispute over scripture.
True, though, according to Nate Parker's much-discussed The Birth of a Nation, Turner's 1831 uprising, it all started with scripture.
Looking forward to this week's Bible study, Josh.
Nation debuted to much buzz and acclaim at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It opens nationwide this weekend.
Our review of Parker's film, plus a preview of the 52nd annual Chicago International Film Festival, which opens next weekend. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. Okay, so you live in Melbourne, Australia, or Arlington, Virginia, or, I don't know, Chino, California?
Maybe Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Oh, man. You did it again.
What?
You did it.
What? That's it.
You did it again. Moving on. What possible interest could you have in our preview of the 52nd Annual Chicago Film Festival? Well, if you live in Oconomowoc, you might actually be able to make the drive down to Chicago.
Far. I don't think it is. Fire at all.
We are going to get to a lot of films that are sure to get releases at some point in theaters, hopefully near you, many later this year, or they may play or may have already played at film festivals near you. So we will try to put some movies on your radar, whether or not you are in the Chicagoland area. We will have that Chicago Film Fest preview, plus Massacre Theater and more later in the show.
But first, Adam and I finally had a chance to see the movie that's been the subject of much praise, and also many op-ed pieces since debuting at Sundance, The Birth of a Nation.
You're a child of God. You got purpose. The law put it there, and nobody can take it away.
These books are for white folks. They're full of things your kind wouldn't understand. You're special, boy Nathaniel. Study hard here.
Your slaves sure do know how to behave.
Well, they God fearing. One of them's a preacher.
People might pay good money to have them calm down a bit, especially by one of their own.
I lead you to Peter 2:18. Submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh.
I'm that. What you think you're doing, boy? I asked you a question.
You done preaching for a little while. Learned your lesson, boy?
Oh, yes. I've learned.
American slavery has been the subject of a handful of significant films in recent years, Adam, from Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained to the recent Roots remake to the Best Picture-winning 12 Years a Slave. New to the genre, if you can call it that, is one of 2016's most talked about films for a variety of reasons. Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation. No apologies, I'm fairly certain, to the D.W. Griffith film of the same name. Parker's picture is a biopic, essentially, based on the life of Nat Turner, who led a deadly rebellion of fellow slaves in 1831 Virginia. Parker plays Turner, and he also directs. The movie was celebrated at Sundance, highly anticipated during a summer in which the Black Lives Matter movement continued to make headlines, and more recently scrutinized in the wake of details that were released concerning Parker's 1999 trial and acquittal for rape. Whew. How do we talk about The Birth of a Nation as simply a movie in light of all that? Should we even, or does it demand a much larger conversation? Well, of course it does, and I'm eager now that I've seen it to listen to the varied voices who will be processing the movie from all sorts of perspectives. For us here, it's probably wisest, given our backgrounds and our experience, to start with that movie question, though, Adam. And maybe looking at The Birth of a Nation in the context of these other American slave dramas is a way to do that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we didn't need another movie on this topic. As far as I'm concerned, we need one weekly until every person in America has finally spent time sitting with the truth of this country's history. But I do wonder, how The Birth of a Nation distinguished itself for you within this genre and tradition. What was most distinctive about the movie when compared to other films that have directly tackled what's been called America's original sin?
Wow, so much to unpack there, and I'm not trying to express any false humility or be overly self-deprecating when I say I think I'm only equipped to really try to unpack the movie question, as you put it, and I'm not even sure I'm able to do that. My excuse is, in this case, I did just come from it. You have had a little bit more time to sit with it. I have no idea what you thought of this movie, and I can't wait to hear your take on it and maybe see if you can help steer me a little bit more in one direction or the other. And I'm certainly not an expert on films that exist within, let's say, the genre. Obviously, have seen and spent some time thinking about 12 Years a Slave, especially Django Unchained, one of my favorite movies of that year. And my gut reaction to The Birth of a Nation is that it's definitely not the film either one of those movies is. And I think part of that is because Nate Parker, in this case, as the writer, the director, and the star, didn't really come up with a way to come at this material in a way that was fresh or that made us see this story with new eyes. Of course, that was built into the narrative of 12 Years a Slave, where he's a free man. So we do see it with different eyes. And then, of course, Django Unchained, Tarantino turns it into this bloody fairy tale slash spaghetti Western, which inherently immediately consider the material in a different way. My feelings at the end of this movie, Josh, were, one, it's not a very good sign when the most powerful moment in the film is the end text. And I thought that was. There's a little bit of postscript, and I'm certainly not worried about spoiling anything here when I repeat it or I paraphrase it. And basically, they report that after Nat Turner was hanged, publicly executed, they then flayed his body. They carved him up into little pieces. They used his skin to make wagon grease or something.
Just awful.
Right?
Awful
okay,
details.
It's awful, but what's powerful about it isn't, of course, the potency of the horror of that. It's the line that follows it, which is that they did it, and of course, this may be a little bit of revisionist history, but they did all that to so try to erase him from history that there wouldn't be any kind of myth of Nat Turner that might ignite more rebellion. And the fact that I, as a viewer, am sitting here in 2016 watching a movie and knowing that there have been books written and that there have been other invocations of this story, that's really powerful to consider that they tried and they failed in that regard. But I come back to the word myth, and I think the thing I kept jotting down in my notes was I kept seeing how Nate Parker was straining for myth instead of just being mythical, instead of just letting the power of the story and the power of that character exude the potency that we would then latch onto and ascribe to it that mythical status. But he can't do it. And there are a lot of examples I'm sure we can get into of things that speak to what I'm saying and that I don't think work in the movie. And then some amazing little moments that are really powerful precisely because Parker doesn't strain to make them be more meaningful than they already are.
I think you're right that this is a much more conventional approach to the material, and the beats that it's trying to hit are more obviously hit. There are a few points of distinction from some of these other films that perhaps allowed me to like it a little bit more than you did, but I would agree it's not at all at that caliber. And newer listeners might be surprised to hear that I'm actually a very big fan of Django Unchained, one of the Tarantino films I like quite a bit, and 12 Years a Slave is just staggering. So in that light, it falls perhaps a bit short, but it has some interesting things going on its own terms. And just to get into a few of them, one is simply a matter of perspective. I noticed how often we were shown, and this has been done in some other movies, but glances among slaves and eye contact being made. Perhaps the best example would be between Parker's Nat Turner and a new female slave who has recently been purchased. Her name is Cherry. She's played by Aja Naomi King. And they look at each other, and there is so much communication. She's actually being sold in this scene, going on without any words expressed. And you get to see this between the house slave as well on the plantation where Nat Turner is raised and now is an adult. He and Nat exchange glances. And that really, for me, solidified the perspective of the movie being with the slaves mm-hmm. in a way that those other films, even 12 Years a Slave, and maybe this was just by fact that Michael Fassbender was in that film and he's such a powerful presence that we sense how things are playing out for him too. Armie Hammer plays that part to a degree in this film. And the movie nods towards his character here and there, but it never really intrudes on the perspective, the boots on the ground perspective that this movie sustains. And I did appreciate that. The other thing which I think is the main distinctive about this film, which completely took me by surprise, not knowing very much about Nat Turner at all, understanding that he was a preacher but didn't know how that played into it. This movie is really framed around one man's attempt to understand what scripture says. Mm-hmm. I described it right after I saw it when I put something on Twitter as a dramatic act of biblical exegesis. So looking at the text of the Bible itself and trying to surmise, what does this mean? What is this saying to me? And there's something really fascinating about that exercise being played out in this historical event, the way Parker's Nat Turner, who is taught to read very early on, mm-hmm. I believe in this narrative, he teaches himself to read essentially. His owners recognize this and give him the Bible. That's mm-hmm. like one of the few books he's allowed to read. And then as he grows up, he begins to read these passages that speak to obeying your master. And he is actually used to placate the slaves, not only on his plantation, but other plantations nearby to keep them calm by using the Bible against them, essentially. Right. And then the trajectory is, here's a failing of the film. This is fascinating to me. And when he starts to read passages differently and different passages, and then recognizes that, no, this is a liberation theology mm-hmm. I should be preaching. And that gives him a new power, and he begins speaking that way. And I think there are some scenes that are interesting. But I, too, never felt this in terms of the character
right.
or the figure. I felt the movie doing this mm-hmm. exegesis, but I did not feel it taking place within Nat's psychology. Part of it is a matter of performance. I think Parker has two modes he's in here. He's in the quiet, docile mode at the beginning, and then he's in the preacher mode, right? And those scenes have their own power individually, but I didn't catch the transformation from one Nat Turner to the other in a way that I think would have really elevated the film.
No, I agree with you. I think, in fact, we know it's a failing of the movie in that a character, in this case, Nat Turner, has to actually express that through words as opposed to through action or through his preaching. There's a point where he actually articulates to some other people, I'm reading the Bible in a different way now. And all we've really seen up to that point is him preaching. We've seen him get a little more righteous and maybe undercutting a little bit of what he knows the white men want him to say to the slaves. But otherwise, there seems to be a pretty quick transformation in that moment where he recognizes that he can find in the Bible passages that contradict every single thing up to this point that he's been reading and has been preaching. So I agree that it's a really interesting element of the film that I don't know that Parker really does explore in a satisfying way. And along those lines, what I was drawn to a bit was the fact that we see a character who isn't just transformed into this rebellion leader because of the horrors that he witnesses, and he certainly witnesses a lot of them, or because he's reading the Bible in a different way, but partly because he's someone who has been given this gift. As you said, he was plucked out early on. It was recognized that he had a skill, that he was someone who could read, and he's been given some chances to learn. He has this skill. And then when he finally gets to go out and use it, imagine that. Imagine being a slave at this time. And rather than working in the field, you get to actually go and do something that no other black man gets to do. You get to travel around and preach to your fellow men. You get to do what you were, in your mind, put on this earth to do. That is such a gift. Except at some point, he begins to recognize that what he is saying is a lie. He's almost now an agent of something mm-hmm. immoral. And that clash in him is fascinating, without a doubt.
Yeah, it is. But could it have been better dramatized? Mm-hmm. I think we're both saying yes. Now, I will say there is a scene where that's handled really well. At one point, his owner is throwing a dinner party, and Nat is there. And he's asked to pray for that dinner party. And this on its own is shocking, that all these white folks sitting around the table are going to let this slave pray for them. And his prayer is, this is where he's playing. I mentioned how he has two modes.
Mm-hmm.
This is where they mix.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's using the same style of speaking, very docile tones. But the words that he has chosen from Scripture to put in that prayer are basically undermining every person sitting there. That's the only scene that really works with that level of complication. Otherwise, we get, again, the fire and brimstone preacher at the end, or we get the quiet preacher at the beginning.
Yeah.
So maybe if there had been some more of that. I think another thing that the movie would have benefited from or amplified that it does well in a few instances is the use of prophetic imagery. And it starts out this way. He's, as a child, brought into the forest, and there is a group of other slaves, and they're engaged in some sort of – the impression is it's perhaps even an African ritual. They're referencing ancestors. They're wearing some body paint. And Nat, as a boy, is brought forward and recognized because of some marks on his skin, identified as a prophet, even as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is somewhat echoed in visions he has later in life, but really there were only two uses of this thread that jumped out at me as fairly powerful stuff. One is when he's holding an ear of corn and suddenly sees some blood coming out of it.
Right.
Just a jarring image on its own that also—
And that seems surreal, actually.
Very
like it's maybe
surreal.
Not really happening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get the sense it's some sort of vision.
Mm-hmm.
And this not only identifies him, again, with this notion of being a prophet, but speaks to the actual blood on everyone's hands. I just like the use of that. And there's another one later on where we see a lynched child hanging from a tree and notice that there's a butterfly that happens to land on his chest. Now, this one plays a little bit differently because it's realism, okay? That this is purported to be really happening. And maybe it would – maybe it's a little bit too much then because it's focusing on this actual butterfly is landing on this actual boy. But if it had done a little bit more in the vein of magic realism, in the vein of how that ear of corn was used
– Right.
It might have been even more effective, but I did like those touches and how the movie emphasized that visually more than through dialogue.
No, there are some great moments like that. There are some other touches where I do feel like he goes too far, and it's something that's really hard to express. But I think about a scene that comes late in the movie, not a spoiler at all, where we witness the shot of a bunch of hanged black men and women. And it's gorgeous. It really is gorgeous in a way that really unsettled me. And usually I will sit here and defend shots all day long and movies all day long that mingle beauty and horror in a really provocative way. But this felt too manicured, too staged, too much about using something that is really horrific to show off what Nate Parker could do with the camera in that moment. Something about it rang really, really false to me. And there are multiple scenes like that.
Well, this is the charge that Steve McQueen faced, director of 12 Years a Slave, because he is such a meticulous framer of composition, you know, being trained as a physical artist originally. And it did not bother me in 12 Years a Slave. I think here where I felt that a little bit is the scene in which Nat is being whipped. And it's, you know, it begins quite poetically where afterwards it's turned to night and we notice that there are candles being set outside the shacks where this has happened. We get a few more candles and it does become this really beautiful image in the use of the lighting, even though he is still tied on his knees to this board. But then the movie does push it a little bit where he does the rise and he stands up.
And the music swells.
The music swells and it closes in and suddenly he's then – there may have been some cuts in between this, but then he's standing there and it's almost a beefcake shot as it pans up his chest. And there's something that offsets the balance there between the beauty and horror, I think, is what you're getting at.
Yes.
And in this scene for me, I felt that that balance was getting a little out of whack.
Yeah, I do want to go back to that dinner scene, the one with the prayer, real quick, because I'm sort of rephrasing what you already expressed, but it is a great scene, maybe the best scene in the film, because it fits in with this larger motif that certainly works into everything you were speaking about when it comes to the Bible, this idea that you can read into the language and draw out whatever conclusions you want. He is praying and he is saying things that all the black people standing around the table can hear the same words the white slave owners are hearing about the fact that God will be on their side against all their oppressors and enemies, right? But then those white people sitting at the table think he's talking about all the people who are out to get them, as if their way of life is crumbling before them. The same words heard by different ears, completely different interpretations of that. That's really interesting. But even more interesting, I think, is what he does visually in that scene, too. And you talk about some glances. Yes, certainly the faces here and the stolen glances between slaves are what matter most here. But there's a moment in that scene where Penelope Ann Miller, I believe, right, is the actress playing the matriarch of this family. She's since moved off the property, but at the beginning of the film, she's the one who takes the young Nat Turner and says, I'm going to help
you
learn
the Bible,
the Bible. And she's sitting across the table from her son. And without Nate Parker underlining it with dialogue, just letting some moments linger, we see on her face, her looking across the table, and she knows that she should be looking at her husband. Her husband is the one who used to hold these dinners. It was part of an annual tradition. And there's just something on her face that suggests she knows this is crumbling. She knows it's gone. She knows her son isn't the man her husband was. And something about their way of life is fleeting. And I love that even more. The way it's shot is it has a bluish tint to it. And the whole time I was looking at Armie Hammer as Sam Turner, I felt like I was looking at a ghost. And I think that's the perspective of maybe Nat Turner in that scene, because he knows what's coming. And it's maybe the perspective of Penelope Ann Miller's character as well, where she's looking at her son and recognizing that this is all going to be gone. At some point, this is maybe our last little hurrah here. And so that's a really good scene that, again, he manages to, just through the reading of scripture and that performance, the subtle performance there from Parker, and the way he captures that, evokes so much. And then you juxtapose that with some of the scenes where I do feel like he goes too far. I'm thinking about the slow motion shot at one point of the young girl, the young daughter of the slave owner, pulling a black girl behind her with a rope, like she's a horsey or a slave she just caught. You don't even know, but they're playing a game. And the fact that he takes the time to show us how that plays out from Nat Turner's perspective, again, in slow motion, there's some heavy-handed moments like that, some real heavy-handed symbolism, again, that by the end of the film, I felt to me like he was spending so much time showing Nat Turner rise up from that whipping with the music swelling behind him. Too much time trying to evoke myth rather than just letting the story be mythical.
Let me ask you about that ending, and especially in light of reading this movie as one man's awakening to what the Bible is saying, at least to him. The fact that the rebellion is put down brutally.
Pretty quickly.
And quickly. And we get a real sense of that. I'm wondering, one of the criticisms that this movie is going to get is that it's celebrating the murder of, which strikes me as, you know, is this really where we're going to start? The fact that 60, I believe, white people were dead. In the aftermath, some 200 slaves were murdered as retaliation. So there is death.
Some free men and women as well. Yeah.
All around here. And I do wonder, the fact that the rebellion failed, does that somehow undercut Nat Turner's interpretation of scripture, you know, in the framework of this movie, not historically, but the way that this movie is presenting this rise of a hero narrative? What does it do then with the historical reality that what he prophesied did not happen? Or do you like how, and can there really be spoilers? I guess there can be spoilers in the aesthetic that the movie presents us with at the end, and we should try to be vague. Do you like or think that it does twist things with that little bit of epilogue that suggests it was still to come?
I don't know. I got to think about it.
Yeah.
I really do. Because
I don't have an answer myself.
No, I don't. Just... And I don't know how true to the facts Nate Parker is being here as
That's
well.
That's why it only matters in the context of this film.
Yeah. I just keep coming back to the idea that we've expressed and that comes up in the movie, where at one point a character who's trying to talk him out of this rebellion says to him, don't forget, he's the God of love. And he says, he's also the God of wrath. And it all comes back to how you choose to interpret those words and how you choose to interpret your role and interpret the signs. He says God will tell them when they're ready, when they should strike. There's an eclipse, I think, is what we see
while they're in the field.
that to him is his sign.
Yeah.
Right. So it's all about how you want to interpret those actions, whether or not you want to ascribe righteousness to them. It's hard to not look back on it now, of course, and not see Nat Turner, of course, as a hero. Of course, despite all the bloodshed, there are some brutal killings of white people here. And at some point, you feel like they deserve it. And then you also, just as an empathetic human being, can't help but feel a little bit horrified by it. So it's playing with those contradictions.
Yeah.
It's aware of those contradictions. And I respect the movie for that.
Yeah. I think it's more complicated than people are going to try to make it out to be. And I would point to a few instances after the rebellion begins in earnest, the night in the film, at least, where they do kill a number of the slave owners. There's a brief cutaway to Nat running behind a shed after he has actually killed someone and just retching.
Right.
And
I thought that was a nice touch.
It's, you know, it at least adds
undercuts
a layer
this
complication.
Wrathful hero, someone who truly is maybe enjoying this, someone who is taking on his destiny, though he does suggest that that's what he's doing, but taking on his destiny and then that somehow making him into a superhero or some kind of character that has no feelings anymore, that has ceased to be human. That moment shows us that, yes, he's carrying out a mission, but he is still a human being who's affected by this. I thought that that was effective.
And the honest depiction of the death that resulted not only during the rebellion, but in the aftermath as well. I think that complicates things also.
One other little moment I just wanted to single out that I thought was really good in the movie. It's early on, and it's that moment when Penelope Ann Miller comes to Nat Turner's mother and says, he'll be living with us for a while. And that's
so
another
casually.
One of those moments. It's so casual, and Nate Parker captures it casually. He doesn't underline it. He doesn't cut to any glances. But if you're paying attention, if you're reading the body language, if you're aware of what that means, that sounds like he's getting this great treat.
That's
right?
How she's presenting
and,
it.
And he is maybe being spared from, at a young age, being put to harder labor, that he gets to go into the big house, right? And he gets to be treated in a more caring manner, perhaps. But think about the mother being told, your son is going to come to our house. He's going to live with us now. And she can't react to that.
Mm-hmm.
She can't let her true feelings be known in that moment. And of course, the white Southern woman in that instance has no sense that that black mother might actually be sad that she's having her son taken away from her. So a really powerful moment that isn't underlined. I really appreciate it. Contrast that with one other scene I wanted to mention that made me feel uneasy. And it's the scene right before something really terrible happens to a female character in this movie. The way Nate Parker shoots it, the moment where we see her out, I think she's getting some water.
Mm-hmm.
He shoots everything about it as if she's almost in the Garden of Eden. This isn't just the South, and maybe there are some beautiful cotton fields, and there are shots that show how majestic the cotton fields are against the blue sky. That's certainly by design. But this one scene in particular, she's wearing white, and she just stands out against this amazing backdrop. It really does look like she's in a heavenly place. And then we get the bad men appear.
Yeah.
And it feels as if he's stacking the deck.
Well,
he's stacking
the blocking,
deck so much.
The blocking in that scene of where the men are positioned, is.
But he makes us feel like she's extra safe and extra protected, only then to have something really terrible happen to her. Those are those moments where I expect to have moments that make me feel uneasy, but I felt maybe a little bit more manipulated getting there than I hope for at some points in this film.
You know, for me, and maybe this isn't a helpful distinction at all, but it struck me when they pulled out Swing Low, Sweet Chariot as the spiritual that they were going to emphasize in this movie. And it's sort of a go-to spiritual. And it works to a degree for the scene, right? But when you think about something like 12 Years a Slave, a powerhouse moment, at least for me, employed a spiritual I was not familiar with before, Roll Jordan Roll at the cemetery. And I somehow that epitomizes the difference between the two films is going, you know, for the conventional and maybe easily emotional attachment choice of a song, or the one that doesn't really serve everything up for you, but in the end ends up being the much more effective choice.
Yeah, and what you said earlier about Steve McQueen, I'll just say, you're right, his background as a visual artist and his mingling of the beautiful with the really repugnant is kind of a hallmark of his work. I'd go back even more than 12 Years a Slave. You maybe see it even more vividly in some of the shots in Hunger. We definitely see that same kind of mingling of the really repugnant with the transcendently beautiful. And there's something about what he does in that film. There's something about what he does in 12 Years a Slave that is more effective and somehow as provocative without making me feel bad about how provocative it is, in a way that I don't think Nate Parker pulls off here, and it's something I'm definitely going to have to keep wrestling with. The Birth of a Nation is currently out in wide release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
We're going to get to some meta Massacre Theater up next. That's right, Adam and I will be playing actors. I don't think we're licensed for this,
No. But
we'll give it a try anyway. Stay with us.
Magnify, magnify, lift it on high. Spit a Spotify to qualify a spot on his side. I cannot modify, ratify. My mama made me apple pies, lullabies, and alibis. The book don't end with Malachi. Devil will win employee of the month by the dozen. To one score in 3 years from the third when he doesn't. My village raised him a child, come through the crib and it's bussing. You meet anyone from my city, they gon' say that we cousins. Shabak, Barak, edify. Electrify the enemy like Hedwig till he passed. Petrified. Any petty Peter Pettigrew could get the pesticide. 79th. I don't believe in science, I believe in signs. Don't believe in signing, I seen dollar signs. Color white, collar crime. Good God, the gift of freedom. Hosanna Santa invoked and woke up slaves from Southampton to Chatham Manor. My dream girls behind me feel like I'm James Early. The type of worship make Jesus come back a day early. With the faith of a pumpkin seed, size mustard seed here. For I will speak noble things has entrusted me. Only righteous, I might just shrug at the skullduggery. I couldn't stand to see another rapper lose custody. Exalt, glorify. Descend upon the earth with swords and fortify the borders where your short is.
This case is about exonerating our entire community. No matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you. Because you're a fighter.
Part of the trailer there for the new documentary from Steve James, he of Hoop Dreams, Life Itself, and The Interrupters. His new documentary is called Abacus Small Enough to Jail. It's about a small family-run Manhattan bank that was the only financial institution to be criminally indicted in the wake of the 2008 mortgage crisis. And the film chronicles the family's attempts to fight that indictment. Abacus is playing at this year's Chicago International Film Festival, a topic, of course, we're going to get to in much more detail here in a bit. But I'm mentioning the James film here because next week we are going to play my conversation with Steve James that happened, I believe, back in June or July. I had an opportunity to moderate a Q&A with him that was really a career-spanning Q&A. The Q&A went about 2 hours.
Yeah.
We will not play all 2 hours, though. That's about the length of a normal podcast these days. But we are, of course, going to play a good chunk of it. And I might get into this on next week's show a little bit. But one of the things I was proud of and that I think Steve James enjoyed is that he's talked a lot about movies like The Interrupters and, of course, Hoop Dreams, now going back to 1994, and Life Itself being the Roger Ebert documentary that got a fair amount of press as well. He's answered a ton of questions about those movies over the years, and I really wanted to focus on a lot of his other films, movies like Stevie and the 30 for 30 he did about Allen Iverson and the town he grew up in, Newport News, Virginia. And I really did spend a lot more time talking about those films and just his approach to documentary in general instead of some of the more popular stuff. And it was a fun conversation. I look forward to sharing it.
And you just about killed yourself in prep for that one.
I did.
So I think it's worth giving it some airtime on the show.
We will do that next week. We have a few bits of housekeeping here, some things that we have already highlighted here on the show in the recent weeks, but these free passes, Josh, they're still available. Certain Women, the new film from one of our favorite directors, Kelly Reichardt, it is opening here in Chicago on October 21st, and there's going to be an advanced screening on October 17th. You still have time to enter to win passes to see that advanced screening. And then American Honey, opening this weekend. Andrea Arnold's film, she's the director of Wuthering Heights, one of our Golden Brick winners.
Yep.
A short time back, the movie Fish Tank as well. We have passes to give away to American Honey during its run. So not an advanced screening, but anytime during its run here in Chicago, you can see it. I know we're both very curious about that film. Shia LaBeouf, one of the stars. It seems to be one of those movies that, what I've gathered from Twitter anyway, is it is dividing people.
Yes, which wasn't the early word. It was pretty rapturous early on. But then as more people have seen it, I've seen some extreme dislikes and then still some of those people on board with it. So I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And then one more plug here for our November live show, part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. 3 days, November 17th through the 19th, we're performing on the 18th, Friday night, the 18th, with Film Spotting SVU, and then our friends at the Next Picture Show will perform on Saturday, the 19th. Tickets are on sale. You can get more information at chicagopodcastfestival.org.
Heard from Drew Brennan, a listener on Twitter today. Yep. He picked up his ticket. So thanks for that, Drew. We'll see you there.
We will see Drew. He's been to other live shows in the past, and we joked a little bit about it last week when we were doing this plug that we thought maybe we could get into some Golden Brick talk, and our producer Sam shot that down, but we do need to sit down at some point and actually figure out what we're going to do on this live show.
We've got more than a month away.
Okay.
Come on. We've got like three or four shows to figure out first, then that one.
Fair enough. Let's get to Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize.
A couple of weeks back, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Abby!
Abby! Don't say anything. Don't say anything. Don't tell me anymore. Everything. Every single thing we've said or done since we've been in that house. Nothing has been between us. Can we just get in our own car and drive back to Boston tonight? We'll just leave everything.
Find us.
How do you go to work tomorrow? How do you look at Avery? What do you say to him?
I talk about work.
That's insane.
I have thought of every possible way. Here in the Caymans, in Washington, that's all I've done. Try to think of a way out. If we run, they'd find us. And it gets Ray killed.
But if you testify...
The FBI says they'll help Ray and protect us.
Protect what? What are you going to do?
Go in tomorrow and start to copy files.
Tom Cruise as Mitch McDear and Gene Triplehorn as Abby McDear in 1993's The Firm, written by David Rabe, Robert Towne, and David Raphael, based, of course, on the book by John Grisham and directed by Sidney Pollack.
McDear, not one of John Grisham's better character last names. That massacre, part of our big Oliver Stone show a couple weeks back. Matt Zoller Seitz joined us for that one. He shared his top five Oliver Stone scenes, and we also had a review of Oliver Stone's Born on the 4th of July, a Sacred Cow review there, and his new one, Snowden. We were less enamored with Snowden than Born on the 4th of July, certainly. So why a Grisham adaptation for this massacre? Well, we heard from Brett in Las Vegas, and Brett's are going to be maybe a running theme throughout this feedback. Brett says, one, both The Firm and this week's Sacred Cow, Born on the 4th, starred the ever-steady Mr. Maypother, that is, Tom Cruise. Number two, both The Firm and this week's reviewed film, the inspiration for the Sacred Cow review, and the top five, Snowden, follow an insider whistleblower who risks everything to expose documents.
You're right on, Brett, but there are other connections.
So many others that we did not expect.
Here we heard from Pam Glaser in Seattle. Also, you could say there's a connection between the broken disillusions of both The Firm and Born on the 4th of July. Each protagonist dedicates themselves to the societal supposed-tos, only to have their lives crumble away from mythic societal ideals despite following all the rules.
Definitely there, Pam. Rob from Vancouver, but living in London. The Firm was an adaptation of the John Grisham legal thriller by the same name, who also wrote The Pelican Brief, which starred the subject of the next week's episode, The Great Denzel Washington.
Very good, Rob. Brett from Chicago, another Brett here. Another show connection is that one of the credited screenwriters of The Firm is playwright David Rabe. Like Oliver Stone, but in theater, Rabe wrote his own trilogy of plays about his experience fighting in Vietnam. Those plays were Sticks and Bones in 1969, the Tony Award-winning The Basic Training of Pavlo Hummel, and Streamers. Rabe is also credited with writing the screenplay for Casualties of War, which was directed by Brian De Palma, who also directed Scarface, which was written by Stone.
Check out the big brain on Brett.
Plus work.
Wow. Kellen Ferguson in Austin, Texas says, obviously Tom Cruise would be the central connection between The Firm and this week's show, but I would gladly reach further and point to the always understated Hal Holbrook. Holbrook plays the villainous character Oliver Lambert in The Firm, a partner in the corrupt law firm that eventually meets its demise because of its seedy practices. One could then look at the Lou Mannheim character in Oliver Stone's Wall Street, a humble, honest, conscientious guide. He seemingly exists to warn the rookies to not feed into the corruption and greed that can tempt many young, ambitious professionals in order to avoid getting lost in that dark, dark abyss. It feels as if one Holbrook character is forecasting the other. Both roles are very memorable, despite being fairly short-lived. Holbrook also portrays Deep Throat and All the President's Men, a film that no doubt had some influence on Oliver Stone's work, notably JFK and Nixon.
Man, people putting so in the good. Overtime on the connections for this one. I love it.
And then we get people who just decided instead to mock slash praise us.
Anthony Gibson in San Antonio, Texas would be one of those. I hope Josh has finally caught his breath or put out those birthday candles he was trying to blow out during that
scene.
You
do have a lot of them now to blow out, Josh.
very funny. I'd like to thank my agent and my inhaler for that performance.
Andrew Johnson in Bayou City, a.k.a. Houston, Texas. Josh, you put the breath in breathy. I actually listened at 2x speed and wondered if you were going to pass out. Adam, you sold the cruise line. Now, this is not a good thing, Josh, when that's really the only compliment I got for my performance. And one other listener did really cleverly point out that we joked in the setup that I was finally going to get to play the tough action star scene. And what's he doing in that scene? He's talking about photocopying documents. That's
the action. You got to start somewhere.
It's not exactly Mission Impossible,
no,
is it? But I think that was the only real compliment I got on my cruise. So not a good thing that I'm going to sit here and praise myself. But I cracked myself up listening back to that replay of that Massacre Theater, because at the end, I very deliberately went for not Tom Cruise, but Ben Stiller's interpretation of Tom Cruise.
You made a creative choice.
I made a creative choice, and I didn't think I nailed it in the moment, but listening to the audio, I nailed it. And I thought somebody who loved the old Ben Stiller show as much as me, and Ben Stiller, also, let's point out, did a great riff on Oliver Stone back in his prime, Oliver Stoneland.
Another connection.
Another connection there. I had to go for it. I thought I did pretty good, but alas, no one commented.
What are you going to do?
Go in tomorrow and start to copy files. I don't have a choice.
I thought you did very fine. I think Sam also complimented you on it. I don't know if that counts, but he appreciated your interpretation there.
He's just trying to boost me up.
And, you know, we've learned that you have a specialty now. You can do Ben Stiller doing Tom Cruise.
That's it.
That, it's good to have a go-to.
That's it. There was one word in my interpretation of Cruise that I hit.
Hey.
I hit it with just that right bit of Cruise emphasis.
As you know, that's all we look for is one word to be on, and we're happy.
Okay. Well, I wonder who's going to win Massacre Theater this week. What could their name be? Josh, reach into the film spotting hat, pick out this week's winner.
We had to go with Brett Duville from Olney, Maryland.
Obviously, a longtime listener of the show. He not only wrote in telling us how to phonetically say Olney Marathon, which we would have gotten wrong because it looks like Olney, but he also phonetically told us how to say Duville, even though...
And was it how I just said it?
Exactly.
Because it's not phonetically here.
I didn't do it because it's so easy, even we could get it right.
Well, never be that confident.
We're looking for sex appeal and yet innocence. We're looking for that certain je ne sais quoi. With that in mind, Richard, I want you to start reading from the top of the page, and I want you to give it to us, but really give it to us.
We get to this week's Massacre Theater, and I'm going to go out on a limb, Josh, and predict that we will not get as many entries as we did for The Firm, and that's a shame.
Yeah, good point. That's a clue there. Mm-hmm. Also, we could say that there are a handful of scenes from this film we could have picked. We're just kind of laughing over which one we like the best. As a matter of fact, within this scene that we've pulled, there were other portions we could have used. So
yes,
a very, very ripe film for Massacre Theater.
Without a doubt. And I think I'm actually combining a couple roles into one here for my performance, if you can call it that. I think that's the only thing we're going to give you.
You can do multiple characters at once.
Multiple bland white characters. That's what I can do. So are we going to give them the hint that it does tie in with The Birth of a Nation?
Yeah.
I think we
should
at least say that.
Yep.
If it doesn't become obvious, Josh, you started out, so I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Let me take a hit from my inhaler. Okay.
And action.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. What it is, bro? I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you, thank you. You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I can do it in iambic.
And scene. You do all your Massacre Theater performances in iambic.
I don't even know what that means.
Someone needs to see some more Shakespeare, apparently. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net.
The deadline is Monday, October 17th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
お寂しいお嬢様をよろしくだの。
あがし。정오되면와서문두드려주고
clip there from one of the most anticipated films playing at this year's Chicago International Film Festival. It's director Park Chan-wook's latest, The Handmaiden. The 52nd annual festival opens next Thursday, that's the 13th, and then it's going to run through the 27th. We're going to get into our most anticipated picks of this year's fest in just a bit, but first, we're going to reveal the results of our current Chicago International Film Festival-related film spotting poll. What we asked you was which film from abroad, we focused on international releases here, which film from abroad that's playing at this year's Chicago Film Festival are you most anticipating. Mm-hmm. So we'll give you the options and we'll give you the results right along with it.
Yeah, normally we give you 2 weeks to vote in these poll questions, but we thought with the fest just around the corner and with enough votes in, and I don't think it's really going to change here. We've got a pretty decisive winner. We might as well transition into our preview of the Chicago International Film Festival with these results. And in last place, A Quiet Passion from Terrence Davies stars Cynthia Nixon as Emily Dickinson. That one last place.
3%. Very surprising to me. Mm. With Sunset Song getting a lot of praise.
And a lot of listeners loved The Deep Blue Sea, and we were fans of that movie as well. In second to last place, The Commune, the latest from the director of The Celebration, Thomas Vinterberg, with just 4%. Christian Mungiu, I think that was where you went.
Yeah.
Graduation, your top pick here.
Not a lot of support.
Only 5%. Mungiu, of course, the director of 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Ken Loach, his Cannes-winning film, I, Daniel Blake, in fourth place. 7%. Then we take a jump up to my pick in this poll, Asghar Farhadi's The Salesman, 17%. Paul Verhoeven and Isabelle Huppert, his star there in the movie L, in second place with 21%. But there it is, number one, the movie we played a clip from, The Handmaiden. I guess there are a lot of fans out there, Josh, of that revenge trilogy, including Oldboy, 43%. Taking the poll.
Impressive. And I hope that's one. Not sure if it has a U.S. release for this year, but it'd be nice if we could catch up with that and include it with the rest of our year-end roundups before we vote for top 10 lists and all that sort of good stuff. It really is an exceptionally enticing lineup at this year's Chicago Film Festival, so it made it difficult for us to choose the five that we most want to see, but we managed to put together a pair of lists anyway. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap. It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap. I don't make songs for free, I make them for freedom. Don't believe in kings, believe in the kingdom. Chisel me into stone, prayer whistle me into song air. Dying laughing with Krillin, saying something about blonde hair. Jesus, black life ain't matter. I know I talked to his daddy. Say you the man of the house now. Look out for your family. He has ordered my steps. Gave me a sword with a crest. And gave Donnie a trumpet in case I get shortness of breath.
I'm gone. Praise him. Praise him till I'm gone.
Don't be mad.
I'm gone. Praise him. Praise him till I'm gone.
When the praises go up.
Good God.
The blessing come down.
We want to take a moment to get to donations and get to our thank yous and some listener comments. We also want to highlight our featured artist this week, branching out a little bit from our usual affair, playing a little bit of Chance the Rapper, Chicago's Own, from his album. I believe it's more of an EP, coloring book. More information at chanceraps.com. My younger friends have recently gotten me into Chance the Rapper.
But I'm an older friend by about a year. I've been listening to this all year long.
Oh, look
and absolutely
at you.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
It's great stuff.
It is good.
It was also, interestingly, the theme for Adeline's homecoming.
No
the
kidding.
Dance. Yeah, coloring book theme. So it is popular with the kids, Adam.
Man, okay. Well, what's also popular is correcting us. And if it had just been one thing, we joked last week about a certain town in Wisconsin. If it had just been one thing, we would have just glided over it. But we got this great email from Mike Rosenholz, a longtime listener. And here we go. I'm just going to say them as they're written, and I hope I'm going to say them right this time because I'm guilty of butchering at least two of these. So Mike writes in, Oconomowoc, Valparaiso, and Herzliya, butchered in the same episode, the latter two in the same email. Add in the free space, and I'm nearly at bingo. I kid. Thanks for keeping me company. Well, you in the final installment of 6 Degrees of Joan Crawford on You Must Remember This as I go about the biannual process of making gefilte fish. P.S. Herzliya was not as bad as the others, but it's what tipped the scales and propelled me to sit down and write the email.
Did we really get Valparaiso wrong?
Well, I think I said it. I haven't gone back to listen. I think I said it, and I do have a tendency to say Valparaiso.
Okay.
And that's because there is a Sting album with a song called Valparaiso, and that's how Sting says it.
Well, there's your priorities.
Yeah.
How Sting says it and the reality.
The way actual people from Indiana say it.
You've got to go with Sting.
I did go with Sting. So I had Valparaiso. I think it's Valparaiso. And then Herzliya is not at all, at least the way it came through via PayPal, it's not written the way Mike writes it here, which is H-I-R-Z-L-I-Y-A. I looked that one up to try to say it properly. Everyone said it's more like T-S, and that's what I went for. And Mike says it wasn't as bad as the others, but apparently I still got it wrong. So
we tried.
The person whose name is slipping my mind right now who gave us that donation, I think it was Noah. N-O-A, right? Who was here visiting,
sounds
saw the movie Sully
right.
at the theater.
Yes,
originally,
yes.
I think maybe from this place in Israel. She actually said at the bottom of the email, good luck pronouncing this one.
Like, it was a trap.
Didn't give us any help at all, just set the trap. Absolutely. Okay. We move from corrections to some donations. We want to thank a Silver Club donor, Mary, in Iowa City, Iowa, a new $5 a month donor, Amanda, in Columbus, Ohio, and a new $10 a month subscriber, Devin, in Abingdon, Maryland.
Dear Film Spotting family, as a much belated thank you for the countless hours of listening pleasure you've given me over the past several years, I've become a $10 a month donor. The show has provided me with stimulating and intellectual movie brain food that I look forward to every week. Whether I'm listening to the show while playing with my dogs outside or commuting to work in Baltimore, I know I will always have thoughtful, amusing, and educational discussion to savor. The recent birth of my son, Cooper, whose name was inspired by our love of the movie Interstellar.
Huzzah!
Wow.
Huzzah!
That's a commitment. Has resulted in me falling behind in my recent listening. But I have been working to catch up, and my enjoyment of the show is renewed every episode. Thank you so much for the time, energy, and enthusiasm that you put into each week. I love your professionalism and passion, and I recommend your show to every movie buff I know. Please keep up the great work. And Devin has a PS here. As a 30-year-old woman who loves movies, I would really enjoy hearing more about current female writers, directors, and filmmakers. Hearing a female name tossed into your film discussions once in a while is always refreshing.
Well, we certainly do try to make a point of that. I think female names come up a fair amount. And if not, we're going to do a pretty good job of that, I have a feeling, as we get to our top five here in a moment.
Yeah, made that a little bit of a priority.
Well, there you go. A gold-level donor, Sandy in Lehi, Utah, who wrote in, Adam and Josh, thanks for being my swim buddies as I listen to your show each morning. Also, Josh, thanks for liking my Meeks Cutoff review on Letterboxd a while back. You completely made my day. And one more thing, the Film Spotting Forum rocks, Sandy in Utah. Indeed, the Film Spotting Forum rocks. There are people there way more intelligent about cinema than us. And if you're not partaking in those discussions, you might just be missing out.
I thought the swim buddy thing was for safety. I don't know if it's quite serving that purpose, just to have us in your earbuds.
You're only good in a canoe anyway.
Well, it's true.
Doug in Tacoma, Washington, also a gold-level donor.
Not only did you mention mask, that's M-A-S-K
that's
during
right.
the show, but you played the theme song. I loved that show as a kid. Before we had a VCR, I would use my cassette recorder to tape the audio of my favorite cartoons and listen to them in my room. Wow, Mask was one of those shows. Another was Centurions. I, of course, had the toys for both. I still love Film Spotting after all these years. My to-watch list continues to grow. I'm a proud subscriber to Mubi because of you, and I am looking into Blue Apron at the moment. You are influencers. Continue to use your powers for good.
I never thought when I was 12 years old that my love of the show Mask, which ran for all of 1 year, would pay off down the road, literally pay off in the form of some donations.
It looks like it.
Yeah, it's all worked out. One final bit of donations business here. We did recently get in our P.O. box, which, if you want to send us a package, you can. The address is on our website, filmspotting.net, under About Us. We got a package from Sam Bass in Decatur, Georgia. He has been a longtime listener, and I guess something we tweeted provoked him to run to his DVD shelf and send us something.
This is an actual handwritten letter.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't even typed. I have to, like, break the wax seal on this thing.
Right.
Okay, here we go. From Sam, I saw in a tweet that Yi Yi is a blind spot for one of you, actually both of us, I believe. What you hold in your hand is the result of my next immediate action upon reading this. I put on my shoes and a hat, as I had just woken up from a nap, drove down to the UPS store on the corner, and put it in the mail.
Real quick, I'm sorry, is Sam 7? He's taking naps? Who gets naps?
I'm a huge fan of naps.
This says something about how alert you always are.
I may take a nap in a few minutes
here.
Well,
I wouldn't blame you, but I mean, I haven't had a nap since I was in third grade.
I used to think naps were for the weak, And then I had children. And I realized they're for the strong. Anyways, Sam was saying, after he woke up from his nap, I didn't even know yet which one of you hasn't seen it. Such was my desperate haste. Please accept this gift, along with my sincerest gratitude for the many hours of education and entertainment. And don't worry about me. I have another copy on Blu-ray. Here's to many more years of the best podcast on the interwebs and to many more blind spots erased.
Yeah, I don't want to sound ungrateful, but not the Blu-ray.
Well,
we
got to
watch Yi on regular DVD, Sam.
Sam, Adam only watches Blu-rays, I'm
That's
afraid.
Right.
So put your hat back on, wake up, get down to the UPS store.
I think Yi is a pretty long movie, too, so this may require another one of those epic Dr. Zhivago movie-watching nights over at the Larsons.
Good idea. Yeah. And that way we can nudge each other if one of us starts to nap off.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sam. And yeah, it really is both of us who need to see that film. Number 8 on that list of the BBC's top 100 films of this century, so since 2000, again, number 8, the highest blind spot by far for the both of us on that list. So something we do need to rectify soon.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least...
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
That was a clip from the latest film, Josh, from one of our favorites here on Film Spotting, at least one of the filmmakers whose names we love to pronounce here on Film Spotting, Denis Villeneuve. The movie
yes.
Arrival, playing at this year's Chicago International Film Festival, as it did at the Toronto International Film Festival recently. October 27th is the date it's playing here in Chicago at the Fest, but it opens wide November 11th. So all of you out there listening, and maybe you've heard some of the good buzz I've been following, certainly on Twitter, seeing some of the responses from Toronto. Amy Adams stars in this film. You heard her there in that scene. She plays an expert linguist, and she is brought in to investigate when a mysterious spacecraft touches down. And as everyone kind of braces for war, she and her team look for answers, the synopsis tells me. So again, a lot of good buzz on this film. And if you're excited to see it at the film festival here in Chicago, we totally get that. But I think that's a movie along with, let's say, La La Land, the latest from Whiplash director Damien Chazelle, that you don't need to really use your time and money to see at the festival necessarily, because there are so many other good films to see and because you know you're going to get a chance to see them. La La Land opens here in Chicago on December 16th, and around the country after opening in limited release on the 9th, it's going to expand from there. So two honorable mentions, I guess, as we're going to highlight the films that we're most excited to see at this year's Fest. But that is something that when people write in and they ask us for advice, they're going to a festival for the first time, and they're looking for any insight if we've been to that festival before. I think it applies to anyone you go to. Seek out the things that you might not otherwise get a chance to see.
For sure.
Did that apply to how you approached this list as well?
Yeah, it did. And I set aside also all of the options that we had in our poll.
Yeah.
So
7 movies there, all promising. But we excluded
definitely
them.
Ones that would be in this list if we didn't set them aside. Christian Mungiu's Graduation, Asghar Farhadi's The Salesman, those would be at the top of that list. So all of that aside, a few titles here that I had not heard of at all before on my list before looking at the schedule and putting them together. And that's certainly the case for my number 5 pick, which is a film called Alba. This is part of the new directors competition. The filmmaker here is Ana Cristina Barragan. She's from Ecuador. And this sounds like it could be something of a companion piece to The Fitz, one of our Golden Brick contenders this year, and a movie that I really fell for. Here's the description for Alba. A curious if withdrawn 11-year-old girl is thrown for a loop when her mother falls seriously ill. Against her wishes, the preteen moves in with her reclusive father, a man she's never met before. She must build a relationship with him while navigating the perils of adolescence, from school cliques to first love. So you can see some of the parallels here with The Fitz. Alba is going to be screening 3 times at the festival. It'll be shown October 19, 20, and 25. And Barragan, the director, is scheduled to attend those screenings on the 19th and 20th. So if you do like the director Q&As that happen at film festivals, maybe circle those dates, the 19th and the 20th, if Alba sounds good to you.
Yeah, my number 5 has a few things in common, Josh, with your number five pick. It's playing three times at the Fest, October 14th, 18th, and 19th. The director slash writer slash producer is scheduled to attend the screenings on the 18th and the 19th, and he is a new director, though this is in the World Cinema category. And the reason why I picked this movie, the film is In the Last Days of the City, is because I wanted to go with at least one choice that was completely off my radar. Not familiar with the director, any of the stars, or really cinema from that country. I am not aware of, at least I'm not aware that I'm aware of any films from Egypt. And certainly this movie, based on the description, seems similar to some of my beloved meta Iranian films from directors like Asghar Farhadi and Jafar Panahi. It's about a filmmaker who is shooting in Cairo, trying to put together footage of everything around him, his mother, his neighborhood, his colleagues, and this coming revolution. This is a movie that started filming in 2009 before the 2011 Islamic Revolution, part of the so-called Arab Spring. So going back to 2009, shot for 4 or 5 years, I believe, capturing all this footage. And like those Iranian films I mentioned, it seems here that the director, Tamir El Said, is very clearly blurring those lines between reality and fiction and imposing a narrative on real events as they unfold. Maybe it's a little bit of an Egyptian medium cool, the great film from the 60s set against the backdrop of the riots here at the Democratic National Convention. One review I found from one of its Film Fest appearances said that the film represents a self-reflexive expression of profound weight and intricate sadness, grappling with loss in myriad forms through separation, death, politics, and ineluctable decay. It won the Best Director Prize at the Buenos Aires Film Festival and won the Caligari Award and was nominated for the Best First Feature at Berlinale. So In the Last Days of the City does come with a bit of a pedigree.
I think I'm in the same boat as you when it comes to Egyptian cinema. I don't believe I've seen a picture from there either. So one definitely worth checking out. In my number four slot, you know, shorts programs can sometimes be overlooked in the rush of a film festival if you're really packing a ton in. But, you know, not only can they feature some great stuff, but they also offer a nice break in terms of pacing if you are powering through a festival schedule. So I wanted to highlight a particular shorts program for my number four pick because it's going to include the work of a Film Spotting listener, mm-hmm. Ben Callum, someone we both had a chance to meet while in New York on separate trips. His film is called Red Folder, and it's going to be part of the Shorts 5 In a Lonely Place presentation. That's taking place at 2:15 p.m. on Saturday, October 22. Ben hopes to be there, and I'm sure he'd appreciate any support from Chicago area Film Spotting listeners who are at the fest. Here's his description for his film. A high school student sets out to find his teacher's elusive red folder, only to discover the unsettling implications of his search. So if you want to make time for a shorts program, mix things up a little bit, there's a good option for you.
I love getting that email from Ben. As you mentioned, we've both had a chance to hang out with him before. He is a New York-based listener. I think we've both had drinks with him on separate occasions. And he wrote in to say he had this film playing at the fest. Nothing brings me more pleasure than hearing from listeners who I know are filmmakers and then finding out that they've got movies playing not just at festivals, but at the festival that's in our backyard.
Yeah, so very cool.
I'm excited to see Red Folder. Want to wish Ben the best of luck there. My number four choice is a film called Things to Come. It's in the International Feature Competition, and it's directed by a filmmaker who definitely could have been in our poll question, looking ahead to the most exciting films at the fest from international directors. And I think she was just left out because I don't think she's as familiar a name to most of our listeners, but over the next few years, that will definitely change. She is Mia Hansen-Love, and the film, Things to Come, stars Isabelle Huppert as a philosophy professor and, according to the official synopsis, soon-to-be empty nester. Approaching the pinnacle of her career, Natalie is blindsided when her personal and professional world crumble around her, and she must search for happiness and the meaning of her own life, a profoundly humanist drama from a rising auteur. I missed Hansen Love's Eden in 2014, a movie that was set in Paris in the early 90s and the underground scene there about a DJ collective amidst a group of friends. But I was a big fan of Goodbye First Love in 2012, a movie I did recommend on the show. And I think Huppert is one of the great screen actresses and great screen presences, period. The subject matter also intrigues me a little bit because it reminds me of 1001 Grams, based on that description. Mm. One of the films from our recent Nordic cinema marathon. You've got a woman whose life is kind of breaking down all around her. She's trying to make sense of it all. It sounds like it could be trite, like that movie was a little bit at times and a little bit too heavy-handed, but I think in the hands of Hooper and Hanson Love, it probably won't be. Our friend David Ehrlich, writing about Eden, said this: if the films of Mia Hansen Love are haunted by the merciless march of time, they're less preoccupied with its passage than they are with its ellipses. Whereas Richard Linklater plays the subject like an accordion, collapsing the years together and pulling them apart in order to transform the space between, Hansen Love bangs on it like a drum, her staccato stories finding beautiful music in the offbeats. I'm eager to see if that applies to things to come as well.
Two Jews have been sent to assassinate Hitler.
This is during the war. They've gotten some intelligence as to where Hitler might be.
They're standing outside his home.
They're hiding. They're waiting for Hitler. 8 o'clock comes. Go. No Hitler.
An hour goes by. He's not home yet.
Where's Hitler?
Then another 2 hours go by. He's not home yet.
Now it's 8:30. He still doesn't show up. And one Jew turns to the other and says,
gee, I hope nothing happened to him.
I'm going to go with a documentary pick for my number three. It's called The Last Laugh. I've mentioned before that I'm something of a comedy nerd, especially stand-up comedy. I don't know if I mentioned, Adam, if I rubbed this in yet, that I saw Chris Rock and Tracy Morgan at Comedy Cellar this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Summer. You mentioned, okay, let me stop you for a quick sidebar. If you're such a comedy nerd, what was the original stand-up comedy show, or who was the original stand-up comic that turned you into that comic nerd?
Ooh, that is a good question. I mean, I started watching Saturday Night Live when I was pretty young. Mm-hmm. So who would have been, you know, doing the monologues in those early days? It's probably somebody like that. I mean, Steve Martin, maybe.
Really?
But I also remember Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
See, back in the 80s.
Your parents.
And even like
your parents, no way they let you watch Delirious like my parents did when I was 7 or 8.
No, but they also weren't at the neighbor's house all the time.
There you go.
So I saw little Eddie Murphy then, and even some Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
You know, around that time when I was really young. So yeah, it started early. And anytime there is a documentary, and there seem to be a fair amount of them that explore the stand-up comedy world.
What makes us laugh, and is it okay to laugh at it?
Yeah, it's not always, you know, the most visually fascinating work, these documentaries, but just when they dig into the actual work of crafting an act and a set, I'm fascinated by that. Now, this one, The Last Laugh, it basically gathers a bunch of Jewish comedians and asks them this question: can the Holocaust be funny? They've got Mel Brooks in this. Sarah Silverman is also a part of it. And then they do, it looks like, include interviews with Holocaust survivors to bring their perspective into it. So potentially this is more grim than funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's a fascinating question and even applies in other areas too in terms of the boundaries of comedy. It seems especially pertinent when you hear more and more stand-up comics saying that in this trigger warning age, they're not even going to perform at college campuses where that is a concern. So this one should be fascinating, probably beyond if you're just a comedy nerd. It's called The Last Laugh, screening twice, October 19 and 20.
Yeah, one I want to see for sure. My number three is a film I've already seen, the only film on my list that I've seen, and it's a movie that maybe many film spotting listeners have seen if they followed along with our Krzysztof Kieślowski marathon. It was the last marathon, Josh, before you join the show, and that marathon had some amazing films in it, the Blue, White, and Red trilogy, The Double Life of Veronique, but the film that got my Best Picture prize, my Best Actor prize, and a 5-star rating, which if you go back over the years, I don't give a lot of 5-star ratings, was Camera Buff, one of Kieślowski's very first features. And here we go back to the filmmaking motif here, but this is a film about a factory worker who becomes obsessed with cinema because his boss wants him to film this big celebration at the plant for the Communist Party. And through that process, starts to really wrestle with some significant artistic questions. And as I said, does become obsessed with it, kind of lets that filmmaking process take over his life. And this year marks the 20th anniversary of Kieślowski's death. So they're showing this film in the World Cinema category. It was a movie that won the Gold Hugo Award at the festival in 1980, and they're showing a restored version of it. So if you haven't seen Camera Buff, I'm recommending it because these are those things that make film festivals so great. Getting a chance to see a film like this that sure you could get from Netflix, or you could go watch a restored version of it on a big screen. And of course, watch it with an audience. And I think this is a movie that would be so great to watch with an audience because it's poignant, it's certainly political, but it's really funny too. And it is a film that ultimately depicts how seeing the world through a lens can completely shift your view of the world and your place within it. It's made a top five, at least once over the years, the movies about art list. And I talked about my favorite scene in the movie there, where his wife finally gets so fed up with him and she's yelling at him. And as she walks out of the room, she comes back because she knows what he's doing. And she turns around and catches him with his hands up in the shape of a frame. So this fight has just taken place, and then he's now reimagining it as if he was filming it. And if he was going to film it, how would he have captured it? So it really does pose some of these big questions about what the responsibility of the artist is. What should art reflect? Should he just capture life happening as some documentarians claim to do, or should he put his own personal stamp on it? It raises those questions. It raises the political questions, as I said, too, but at the same time is just a funny human drama as well.
I don't necessarily need a Kieslowski marathon. I've seen a fair amount of his films, including all of the Decalogue, which is now out on Criterion. Speaking of things you can watch at home, but I've not seen Camera Buff. So
October 15th is your chance.
And I completely agree with you when it comes to these restorations too. I get very excited when I see that a festival has these. Yet your instinct might be exactly what you said. Well, why waste my time there? But there's just something so great about seeing it on a big screen. One of my honorable mentions is another restoration.
All right.
We'll get to that in a minute. But at number two, I have a new film, Moonlight. And there's good recent word of mouth on this one. It's part of the festival's Black Perspective series. It comes from writer-director Barry Jenkins. And like Alba, my number five pick, and like The Fitz, it's another coming-of-age drama described as a story of a young man's struggle to find himself, told across three defining chapters in his life. Moonlight, I've heard about here and there, but just recently it's been getting some really high ratings from critics I follow on Letterboxd. I noticed that Michael Casey and Alyssa Wilkinson both really liked it. I think they gave it between 4.5 out of 5 or 5 out of 5 stars there. This is Jenkins' first feature, so I think Moonlight we can also consider to be a potential Golden Brick nominee if we're both able to get to it. It's only screening once. That's October 26, but this is also one of those, I think it's opening in Chicago at least, October 28. So if you can't get tickets to that one, there will be opportunities not too long after for Moonlight.
Yeah. Did you see Jenkins' first film, Medicine for Melancholy?
I did not.
I did. Wyatt Cenac in that one. A good film, a very promising first film, a movie I think fair to say feels like a very promising first film, but is just that. It's not overly ambitious in its scope. And I am really excited to see what all the buzz is about with Moonlight. My number two pick is another film that is a restoration, but one I haven't seen. And it's part of the Black Perspective special presentation at the festival. The movie is Daughters of the Dust. It's been restored for its 25th anniversary. Julie Dash, the filmmaker, a movie that is about a family on a small South Carolina island set at the turn of the century. They're descendants of West African slaves, and according to the description, they clash in their struggles to preserve their heritage while forging new lives for themselves in the U.S.
I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the barren one, and many are my daughters.
Now, Josh, until 2 years ago, I don't think I'd ever heard of the movie Daughters of the Dust. And then three things transpired. One, I was programming and then ultimately teaching my Tribute to Roger Ebert class 2 summers ago at the Graham School at the University of Chicago. And one of my picks was Eve's Bayou because, of course, this was a movie that Ebert famously championed, his number one film of 1997. And as you know, you've been to a couple of my classes and helped and participated there. I like to look for context. I like to find other films that I can point to as direct influences or maybe just films that will help direct our discussion later. And I was having a really hard time coming up with options for Eve's Bayou. And then I read this from Ebert. While there is a precedent for Black-directed films in rural settings about women and their daughters, including Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, Lemon's Bayou further challenges the way a male-defined urban aesthetic has come to define new Black cinema. Parallels between Dash's Daughters and Lemon's Bayou stop there. So obviously right then, I knew I had to get my hands on this film. I couldn't find it. Mm. I couldn't get my hands on it, so we couldn't watch any scenes from it in class. That was the first thing. The second thing was, just this past May, Slate came out with their Black film canon, the 50 greatest movies by Black directors, and Daughters of the Dust, not only on the list, but one of 15 movies directed by a woman on that list, along with Casey Lemons for Eve's Bayou. Daughters of the Dust was, in fact, the first feature film directed by an African-American woman to be released in U.S. theaters. So there is a real legacy and a real impact this movie had. And I just want to read one small quote from that Black Film Canon article. They say, despite everything, Black filmmakers have produced art on screen that is just as daring, original, influential, and essential as the heralded works of Welles, Coppola, Antonioni, Kurosawa, and other non-Black directors. Films like Daughters of the Dust, Killer of Sheep, Tongues Untied, and Fruitvale Station deserve to be considered alongside the artistic masterpieces of the past century in cinema. So, pretty bold claim there, but they're putting Daughters of the Dust in that Pantheon-level category. The third thing that happened was Beyoncé released Lemonade, which you have seen, and I still have not had a chance to see, but apparently a lot of the visuals in Lemonade were inspired by the imagery seen in Daughters of the Dust, and there's an article I'll link to in our show notes that talks a little bit more about that. So if you're a fan of the Queen Bee and you want a little bit more perspective to help you understand what she's after there in Lemonade, seeing Daughters of the Dust might help there. Again, Restored, it played at Cannes in May. It's now made its way to the Chicago International Film Festival. It's playing on October 23rd, the night before. I'll throw this out for people still making their plans, because I think tickets are available on October 22nd. They're paying tribute as part of this Black Perspectives presentation to Steve McQueen, who we talked about during our review of The Birth of a Nation. They're going to pay tribute to him. He will be there at that event on the 22nd, but Julie Dash will also be in attendance on the 23rd to do a Q&A after the screening of Daughters of the Dust.
That is the other restoration I was thinking of. That was my honorable mention, Daughters of the Dust, a blind spot for me as well. My number one is a movie called Raw, and I've had my eye on this one since hearing about it earlier this year. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be your number one, Adam. Let me just offer you the description. That'll explain why.
I don't know why you would say that. Read away, Josh.
Justine's having a tough time adjusting at her new veterinary school. After the timid vegetarian is forced to eat raw meat for the first time in a hazing ritual, she's overtaken by a different sort of insatiable hunger and an unexpected sexual appetite. This gruesome feminist horror tale cooks up a deadly dish of sexual identity with a dash of dark humor and a generous helping of gore.
It sounds great.
Coming with me?
I'm totally coming with you. I mean, of course, it's way past our bedtime. We'll never be up if it's part of the After Dark
series. Part of the After Dark series. So that could be a problem. But this is just, it sounds too bizarre.
That's a great synopsis.
So really,
I'm hooked. I'm in.
Okay, good. It comes from the director, Julia Ducournau. And yeah, it is part of their After Dark series. Two chances to see it. I think one of these is like around 8, so it's not crazy.
Okay.
I mean, we might even be able to handle it. The dates are October 21 and October 22.
All right. Well, my number one is not nearly as surprising, maybe, though the subject matter might be just as shocking. It's a film whose title came up, Josh, in some feedback as we were sharing the poll results to our most anticipated fall movies about a month ago. And the movie is Christine, from director Antonio Campos. It's part of the International Feature Competition. It plays on October 15th and 16th, and it's the movie about Christine Chubbuck, a Florida newscaster who killed herself on air live in 1974. A true story. Maybe I had heard of this at some point in my life, but if I did, I had completely forgotten it. I'm a big fan of Rebecca Hall, who plays the title character and who's getting all sorts of raves for her performance of Christine Chubbuck, and there's just something so inherently dark and mysterious and compelling in that subject matter. You just read one line from that plot synopsis and I'm hooked. How could you not want to try to understand what drove a person to do something like that? And Campos is a very stylish filmmaker who has made two previous films about people who kind of have two faces, the face they show to the world and the face they see in the mirror. After School and Simon Killer, both interesting films, the disparity between those two faces may be not as obvious because the main characters are so introverted, they're very silent, we project onto them perhaps more than they project an image of themselves. But here in Christine, you've got a character who is a news anchor. She's an on-air personality. Every day, she's presenting herself to the world and is performing, if you will. So I'm really, really curious to see how Campos navigates that and if he plays it a little more straight because it's based on a true story and maybe doesn't get as out there stylistically as he does with the other two films. But for me, that's hands down the movie of the fest, the one I am most eager to see.
Everybody, this is my friend Christine.
I'm a reporter at WZRB, and I'm always on the lookout for a positive human interest story.
Here we go, folks. This is my first strawberry of the season. Yeah, it's juicy.
We're going to play a little exercise called Yes, But.
I really wish that I could get a job promotion.
Why don't you ask for one?
Yes, but they say I have to do different work.
We need higher ratings. If it bleeds, it leads.
This is totally at odds with the work that I've been doing. It's exploitative.
Why don't you try a compromise?
Yes, but, and I won't be doing the work that I love.
Why not try to get me something like this?
So what, get some footage of some fat people burning in a car crash?
Jesus Christ, just make your stories juicy.
Why don't you do different work?
Yes, but if I do different work, then I won't be doing the work with the man that I love.
Good evening, Sarasota.
Those are our top five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movies. Josh, you alluded to at least one honorable mention. What else do you have?
Well, the other two I'd highlight, one comes from a filmmaker who is a fairly familiar name, maybe could have been part of our poll collection. That's Japan's Hirokazu Koreeda. His new film is called After the Storm that will be at the fest. And then a movie called Apprentice from Singapore, somewhat similar to Egypt in that I don't know if I've seen a film from Singapore before. This tackles that country's handling of capital punishment. Looked pretty intriguing to me.
I've got a lot here, so I'm going to go really quickly, and I don't want to undercut your number two choice, Josh, of Moonlight. For me, an honorable mention, but a movie that is scheduled to open here in Chicago and in limited release October 28th. So if you miss it at the fest,
right,
you should get a chance to see it. Some of the other titles I'm looking forward to October 15th at the fest is Patterson, the latest from Jim Jarmusch, starring Adam Driver. Trespass Against Us plays October 21st, one I didn't know anything about. It's from a director I'm not familiar with, Adam Smith, but I saw the picture there on the SIFF website, and it looks like they're having a very heated exchange, one Michael Fassbender and Brendan Gleeson. What more do you
You're
need
in.
To know? I mean, I'm definitely in for Trespass Against Us. And then a couple I can recommend. The B-side, Elsa Dorfman's Portrait Photography, the latest from Errol Morris, plays at the fest on October 15th, and the latest from Steve James. More on that next week. Abacus Small Enough to Fail plays on October 18th, and James and the producer Mark Mitten are scheduled to attend that screening. I have two more for you, Josh. American Anarchist, a documentary that plays on the 15th and 16th. It's from Charlie Siskel, a Chicago director, just like Steve James, who made Finding Vivian Mayer. And here he's making a documentary about William Powell, who at age 19 wrote The Anarchist Cookbook. And he's now in his 60s and apparently is really haunted by his own creation. This is a book that gives you instructions on how to make explosives and how to manufacture illicit drugs, including LSD. This was a real seminal work that came out at the height of the counterculture in protest of the Vietnam War. And I don't know a whole lot about it, but just this whole idea of looking back on that and having some real strong feelings against what you did at age 19, that fascinates me. My last one I'll mention is Finals. The director, who I'm not familiar with, Adele Yaragi, is scheduled to attend the screenings on October 15th and 16th, but this is a film co-written by the sadly recently departed great filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. So if you're a fan of his work, getting a chance to see another one of his films, even if he didn't direct it, on the big screen might be worth seeking this picture out.
A lot of good stuff there.
There is indeed. And we went through so many titles we know, and fairly quickly. If you want to circle back and remind yourself of some of the movies we brought up, maybe you're still putting your list together of movies you're going to see at the festival, or maybe movies you're just going to seek out later, you can find the full list at filmspotting.net. Just click on Top Fives. The Chicago International Film Festival kicks off October 13th and runs through the 27th. More information available at chicagofilmfestival.org.
If you have any comments about the show, you can send those to feedback@filmspotting.net. As I mentioned, I'm really interested to hear the different takes on The Birth of a Nation. How about a few voicemails on that? You can leave those at 312-264-0744. If you didn't catch that number, it's under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam's at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Also at filmspotting.net, there are 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are in the show archives. And if you haven't already, we ask that you do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. We've got The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. Both of those are on iTunes or via whatever podcast app you use.
Out in wide release, Emily Blunt stars in The Girl on the Train, the new kids comedy Middle School, and The Birth of a Nation is out. I'm with you, Josh. Look forward to those responses. In limited release, Under the Shadow, a horror film set in post-revolution Iran. It's got an 86 currently on Metacritic, and Andrea Arnold's American Honey. Next week, our radio and podcast listeners will hear my conversation with the great documentary filmmaker Steve James. His latest film plays the Chicago Film Fest on the 18th.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. The music on this week's show is from Chance the Rapper. It's taken from his album Coloring Book. More information is at ChanceTheRapper.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Got an email from Brad in Oconomowoc.
How many people live in Oconomowoc? I mean, is this like an enormous metropolis I was unaware of? What's the population there? Has everyone emailed us?
I think it's 17.
And they've all emailed
they
us.
They all listen to Film Spotting. Let's look it up. I'm looking it up.
There can't
what
be,
is your actual
there
guess?
There can't be more Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Not Japan. Like,
Japan is huge metropolis. Okay. Oconomowoc, I'm going to say, has a population of 19,322.
I'm going 13,527.
Okay.
The answer is, according to the 2010 census, split in the middle, 15,759. So about the same size of the town I grew up in.
Well, and there was a huge population explosion in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, about 2013, I believe. So I'm sure there's a ton more people there
who are
listening to. That was because a moccasin-making company transferred from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and moved their headquarters to Oconomowoc, bringing in a whole new population.
Oh.
Who are very sensitive about the pronunciation of their town.
Film Spotting is listener-supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.